Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks for joining us again. I just got off the phone with Shengqing Wu to talk with her about her new book, Modern Archaics, Continuity and Innovation in the Chinese Lyric Tradition, 1900 to 1937. This came out in 2013 with the Harvard University Asia Center. Now, this is a book I really, really loved, both because of the ideas that you'll hear us talking about over the course of the book, but also because of the really gorgeous prose style, the really gorgeous writing that you will find throughout the book, both in Shengqing's own prose and also in her translations of the many, many poems that stud the book. It's just really, really a gorgeous reading experience. So the book looks at the practice of classical poetry, a very particular form of poetry, in early 20th century China, as there is a social and cultural and political transition from the Qing to the Republican period. And what it does is it looks at the ways that a number of poets, some as individuals, others as part of communities that grow up around the practice of these forms, used these formal constraints of a kind of style of poetry that some might otherwise deride as, you know, too stiff, too formal, too constrained, to actually innovate, to challenge prevailing norms of writing and thinking about the world, and to really create new means of writing selfhood, new forms of being, new ways of writing. And so Shengqing Wu in here is really challenging a kind of flat-footed, static notion of a tradition and a modernity that stay put and that exist as polar opposites. The book really completely upends that way of understanding tradition and modernity in the context of late Qing and Republican China. So in the service of helping us rethink the generative nature of classical style poetry in the book explores some key questions. And these are questions that I'm taking right from the book itself. How, this is question number one, how, as a growing need developed for a new vocabulary and aestheticism to express the unprecedented turmoil of the time and to introduce new ideas, did this particular style of ornamented lyrics come into vogue? Second question, how did the style's surface qualities and form relate to the substance to ultimately communicate profound meaning? And third, what role did the style play in literati life? So those are questions taken from Shengqing herself. Over the course of the book as well, as you'll hear, there are some gorgeous, gorgeous poems. And so please get yourself a copy of the book, give it a read and enjoy because it's wonderful. Not only do humans love it, but as you'll hear midway through or sort of early midway through the interview, cats love it too. And you'll hear my cat Habibna scratching around at one point as in evidence of the fact that she clearly felt really strongly about the book. And in fact, what Shengqing didn't know when I was talking with her is last night I was reading Habibna poems from the book and she really loved it too. So it's good for humans and cats. You heard it here. It's a really wonderful book to read and it was really wonderful to talk with Shengqing about it. So I hope you enjoy the book and I hope you enjoy the conversation to come. Thanks for listening. I'm here to talk with Shengqing Wu about her really wonderful new book, Modern Archaics. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Shengqing, and thanks very, very much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kara. Thanks for having me on.
Of course. So, Shengqing, could you start us off by saying a little bit about your background, and specifically, how did you come to decide to work on poetry in modern China?
Sure. I was a major in Chinese literature when I was an undergraduate student at Fudan University. And then I went on to study my MA with a concentration on the late imperial literature, especially Ming and Qing dynasties. But at that time, I have no idea what I was going to do. And then I went to U.S. to attend UCLA in late 90s. And I must say that my advisor, Professor Ted Hughes, is the person who really sparked my interest in late teen period. So a couple of us, his students, was working on the late teen literature. And for us, I think it is a time period unlike the May 4th time period, is that this is a time period is that not only China is not only experienced this drastic political and the societal changes, but this is also a time period full of the intellectual energies and the different possibilities that the intellectual discourses can take. So that's why this time period become very fascinating to me. So when I started with my dissertation proposal, I started with a very naive goal. I simply want to locate a so-called alternative voice in the May 4th discourses. My dissertation proposal covers a range of topics, and I plan to start to write one chapters on classical poetry. I want to find out what exactly happened to this form. But fortunately, I think I started with writing that particular chapter, and then I realized I truly stepped into a very rich field that I could well devote the rest of my scholarly life. So this is after 10 years later, more than 10 years later, I think, this is the product.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So the book that we are here today to talk about explores classical poetry in the early 20th century in China, and it looks at the ways that this kind of formal elements of classical poetry were sort of manipulated and changed and used in order to react to political, cultural, and historical necessities of the time, as you put it in the book. And we'll talk much more about this later on in our conversation. It's an amazing set of case studies that take us through what happened to be some really interesting and I think really transformative ways of rethinking some really crucial and fundamental historiographical points about, you know, modern China, but also how we understand language and poetry and translation. So you've said a little bit about how you came to the topic, and you mentioned that this began in some ways a dissertation project. So can you, for us, talk about that transition from dissertation to book? Were there any major transformations in the project or in how you were thinking about the topic?
Sure. This my dissertation, as I mentioned, is that I personally realized I stepped into a very rich field, but at the same time, this is uncharted territory, since there's so many materials and so many fascinating poets. So personally, I just, when I was writing my dissertation, I feel like I don't know how to handle those materials. So in the way that I did sort of very mechanical way is that I choose the three representative poets, and I wrote three chapters in my dissertation. So I choose Zhu Zhongmou, which I think is a representative poet of this particular genre called Ci, song lyrics, and then the Chen Shanli, who is the representative poet of this style called Tongguang style poetry, which is modeled after Song Dynasty poetics. And then this fascinating female poet, Lü Bicheng. So it is a very author-centered kind of approach to the materials. When I revising my dissertation into a book, since I already spent a few years to working through the materials, at that time, I personally feel that I have a much better grasp of the materials and the overall formed overall pictures of the poetic writings during that time. So this book is significantly expanded. So I have 6 chapters, and also some chapters I have this more theme-focused kind of approach. Since after I go through those materials, I did form the more general assessment and ideas about those poets and their writings. So I'm happy to see that the book is significantly enriched and different from the dissertation project.
Wonderful. It's also just rich, very, very rich as a book, and it's also written in absolutely gorgeous prose. So I just want to get that right on the table at the beginning. It's absolutely beautifully written.
Thank you.
It's very writerly, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
So the introduction to the book opens with a description of the poetry of 13th century writer Wu Wenying in a 1927 anthology. And here's the description. This is a quote. Wu's song lyrics are like a 7-tiered treasure pagoda that dazzles the eyes, but when broken apart, the fragments cannot be formed into a coherent whole. So you go on to talk about the image of the treasure pagoda as a way of talking about classical style poetry at the turn of the 20th century, and you talk about the aesthetics of that poetry using the term ornamental lyricism. So can you get us started by talking a little bit about that concept? What is ornamental lyricism for you, and in what way is that central to what you're doing in this part of the book?
Okay. I use this ornamental lyricism to refer to a range of formal and aesthetic attributes and as well as the practice. What I meant by that is this group of the poets, they're deeply committed to the literary and poetic conventions and the forms. Their extensive use of the allusions and also the very beautiful and ornamental classical language and the imageries, and also this use of the these rhetorics in the poetry called bi and xin. So in the way that they are deeply, they had this type of deeply formal commitment. At the same time, I also use this ornamental lyricism to refer to a kind of social practice, means that they are committed to this kind of literati ideal about the elegant lifestyle. And it is also represent the certain kind of cultural ideals that they deeply committed to. And at the same time, I also use ornamental lyricism in a sort of ironic way, because this group of the poets during the May 4th period, they are really attacked by the May 4th intellectuals. So the way that they were being attacked is that is exactly because their language is ornamental, and also which revealed the certain sense of the over-decoration and also the social irrelevance. So for instance, Chen Duxiu would say that the classical poetry, classical literature is the clay doll that printed up by the makeup. So in that sense, I try to use this ornamental in a little kind of ironic way in response to the attack and criticism from the vernacular literature camp.
Yeah. Great. Amazing. And you say right at the beginning of the book as well, and I think the book does this very effectively, that in part because the style is so associated with very negative values, the book, among many other things, is going to challenge that way of understanding 20th century classical poetry and really help us appreciate it in a very new way. And it does that very well. Now, in the book, and early on in this introduction, you introduce the notion of modern archaic. So this is also the title of the book, and it happens to be a very important notion here in the introduction. And you introduce this notion as a way to inform and also move beyond a discourse of tradition and modernity in the book. So can you talk about that for us? What do you mean by modern archaics, briefly? And can you talk about this in relation to the kind of work you're trying to do here to ask us to problematize these notions of tradition and modernity that we might come to the book already having formed?
Thank you. When I spent a few years to work on those materials, I think we know that in our field, in the modern Chinese literature, that this concept of the modernity is ubiquitous, and also people come with this, a revised version of this concept, such as multiple modernities, alternative modernities, etc. So when I was working through my materials, I really grow this kind of dissatisfactions with this use of the modernity. I think in many ways, it is a really a limited kind of tool, a concept to, especially when I was dealing with my materials is so highly formal and aesthetic. So I think in the way that I try to postulate this template that to couple this modern and tradition in order to emphasize this type of conflictual and contested nature of this formation of the modern culture during that time, while highlighting their mutually transforming power. So I try to suggest that they are paradoxically a codependent framework. But at the same time, I also use the modern as an adjective, since I think I try to not privilege of this concept of being modern or concept of the modernity. Instead, I want to emphasize the tradition is a location that I'm going to investigate. And this is also a location that full of the energy and the dynamics, and it's a living enterprise. So I really hope, although I don't really know whether I accomplish that, is that I really try to go beyond this concept of the modernity in the way that to treat the modernity and tradition in a more dialectic kind of form. But at the same time, this book is titled Modern Archaics, so it's not in the way that modern tradition. The reason I want to use the archaics instead of tradition, is also have the several concerns. One is that for the stylistic and aesthetic kind of concern, is that a group of the poets and the poetics that I deal with in this book is that they are the people really invoke the distant past and not immediate past, and their extensive use of archaism in their writings. So in many ways, the archaism is part of their aesthetic and poetic style. So I really want to emphasize that aspect is not only just committed to the tradition, but they are committed or invoke the distant tradition, turn it into a kind of archaic kind of approach to the tradition. But at the same time, the archaics is also in the way that is, to a certain extent, is a poetics. And it's a part of a kind of aesthetic idea and the ideology that they are fully committed to. So so in that sense, I also want to emphasize that aspect. So I couple it, the, postulate this template together as a modern archaics. Great.
Thank you so much. And in fact, you mentioned the importance of style, and style or form is a really important part of the book. So the book discusses, and we'll talk about the details of this, the importance of understanding and using lyric form in the Qing. And this is really, I really appreciated this as a historian. And you can hear my cat in the background is also really appreciating this right now as she scratches the wall saying, yes, this is one of the things I loved about the book too. I really appreciated this part of it because what you're doing here is not, as you put it, mining poems for the cultural and historical information inscribed in them, but paying careful attention to the formal aspects of the poem. Yes, Habibna. Great. I know. You agree also. That's fantastic. And speaking of form, part one of the book is called A Formal Feeling Comes, and this is named after an Emily Dickinson poem. It looks closely at the relationship between, as you put it here, historical trauma and the poetry of mourning, and it traces some ways that an important group of late Qing intellectuals looked for literary strategies to help them deal with loss. Now, that loss is coming in the aftermath of 1900, with the invasion of foreign troops and the subsequent flight of the royal family in 1900. This is the year of Gengzi, and we'll talk about the importance of that in a moment. Chapter one focuses on the writing of poetry in the in this context. Okay, so you're arguing in this part of the book that the poets, when faced with kind of major social changes that are coming out of 1900, are clinging to a lyric tradition and a stable poetic form that offered them some kind of solidity among shifting grounds. And you do this by bringing us into two really fascinating case studies. The first case study is a literature around the death of Zhen Fei, the Guangxu Emperor's royal concubine. So can you talk about that for us? It's a really amazing case study. Why and how did Shi poetry become so important in the context of literature about Zhen Fei?
Okay, sure. This chapter actually revised from my the dissertation chapter on the Zhuzhu Mou. So when I was researching the materials about the Zhuzhu Mou, the one cultural phenomena was caught my attention is that Zhuzhu Mou and his cohort write a good number of poems about the death of the Zhen Fei, and that caught my attention in the way that, well, we all know that, you know, the death of a beautiful woman is tragic, but in the way that consider the scale of the Gengzi incident, it's a disastrous in many ways. So why this incident in particular that was caught the attention by this group of poets? So I did some research on this very tragic fate. This woman with very tragic fate, Zhen Fei, and I absolutely fascinated by her stories. As a matter of fact, not only this chapter, I also wrote a paper on her, together with another notoriously known figure, that is Cai Jinghua, to show that how there are their image in the literary and historical sources coming from this kind of, to a certain extent, neglected or a less known loyal concubine or courtesans to emerge as a national hero in the late 1930s. Through the films and the drama. So it's really an intersection between this kind of female image, female body, and the nationalism and the gendered imagination through the mass media. So in the way that the trajectory of her story is fascinating to me. So I wrote in that article. But here, return to this chapter, I find in the way that this very interesting to work on her case is in the way that several things are coming together at this moment in terms of the Zi poetry writings. So first of all, we have this historical incident here that is the death of the royal concubine, and at the same time, the emperor was on the free towards the west part of the China. And then this group of the poets, they were just left in this occupied city of the Beijing. So this is the historical situation here. But at the same time, we also need to consider to the generic tradition of the Ci genre. We know that in the Chinese literary history, there is a very developed, established tradition. This is called Xiangchao Meiren. So it's called fragrant paint and the beauty of this tradition from the Ci. So in the way that when the poet write about the beautiful woman's longing for the absent husband, is in the way to express their loyalty to the emperor, to express their spiritual pursuit to the political and cultural ideals. And this is a very established kind of literary traditions. But I must emphasize that in the late 19th century, this type of tradition was really revoked in the Ci poetry writing. We know that the Ci poetry writing is always write a lot of about the romantic love love emotions. But during that times, when they write about the love poems, it's always most likely it is a veiled kind of criticism or an expressions about a certain kind of political message. So it is interesting to see that here, in this case, this female image is really become a composition of a real historical character that is refers to the Zheng Fei, and also it's a literary figure that is associated with this long writing tradition of the fragrant plant and the beauty tradition. So in many ways that this female image epitomized their longing on the literal level, such as to the absent emperor who is on the run at that time, but more metaphorically and allegorically that expressed this their kind of political message about the falling apart of the of this political system, but at the same time it's also a very general sense, the falling part of this whole culture system. So I think in many ways this kind of multi-layered message is really revealed very well through this very concrete female image and this very tragic kind of incident happened during that time.
Thank you so much. Now, the other case study in this chapter looks at, we won't have time to talk about it in any detail, just in the interest of moving on, but it looks at an anthology called Song Lyrics of the Autumn of Gengzi, which was collectively composed by three poets in Beijing while it was under attack. And I mention this in part so that I can mention that one of the three poets, Wang Pengyun, Liu Fuyao, and Zhu Zumo, one of these poets, Zhu in particular, was known as Dr. Rhyme, and I just love that. So anybody who's listening, feel free to steal that. Dr. Rhyme. You heard it here first. And they actually had a kind of little poetry club where they would get together and write poems together every night. And also feel free to steal that idea as well, listeners. Poetry club, make sure you get to be Dr. Rhyme. So chapter two looks in particular at this kind of debate in the air, and you locate it in a specific debate between two people at the beginning of the chapter, between kind of how to balance freedom of expression with formal constraints and formal restraint. The chapter looks closely at the work of Chen Sanli, Now, he was a poet of the Tongguang school, which flourished during the reign of Tongzhi and Guangxu emperors and promoted a kind of poetic style of the Song dynasty. He and his dad were exiled and then pardoned in 1900, and his dad died suddenly the summer after the pardon. The death of his father and the larger context of the kind of national upheaval that was happening at the time occasioned in him, in his writing and himself, an outpouring of lyricism. An outpouring of lyrical writing. So in this context, as you say, in this part of the book, he kind of turned formal constraints of the poetic genre he was working in into tools of innovation. And because this is an important point that speaks to this larger idea of modern archaics, right, this larger idea of, you know, finding innovation in what we might otherwise disregard as mere tradition, I'd love if you could talk a little bit about that element of what he was doing. How, or what's maybe one example or two examples of how he was turning formal constraints into tools of innovation in a way that you find is important.
Okay, sure. There's the Chen Zhanli, this he is a representative figure of this so-called Tongguang style poet. And as a matter of fact, that in the past decade, that the reputation of the Chen Zhanli is has been significantly revived in the mainland China. And this is the reason is a little ironic in the way that because he is also the father of a prominent historian Chen Yingqiu. In the way that because people interested in his son Chen Yingqiu, and then revived the reputation of the Chen Zhanli, and the Kara, you summarized very well about the main points that I try to made in this chapter. I want to say that in this chapter I want to express the two main things. One is that, as you already mentioned, that after the death of his father, that the Chen Zhanli was really in his poetry writing, he is really outpouring his sentiment in terms of this kind of personal trauma, and write about the personal trauma and also the political trauma he experienced during that time. So this is one kind of historical moment. And the second key moment for him is also the fall of the dynasties. So in 1912, that is also the very crucial moment for him and for his group of the poets, that in the way that because the dynasty was gone, and in the way that the culture they are familiar with falling apart. So in that kind of sense, I try to argue that the function of the classical poems and is really changing in the way that during that time, this form is really turn it into a kind of weapon for the struggle for the meanings and for the making a sense of the world when their world was falling apart. And at the same time, I also talk about that his formal experiment in some ways in this in his struggle of the meanings, because in the way that this kind of more or less complete, coherent, linguistic vision that usually expressed in this classical poems, in these forms, is a shattered. So in many ways, this kind of disintegrated kind of perceptions about the modern world is really kind of stimulate him in many ways. And his poetry was react to this kind of new perceptions and new change of the world. Specifically, he was, for instance, in his writings, that he liked to use a lot of difficult diction, a lot of very unfamiliar classical vocabularies, even unfamiliar to his contemporary readers. So one anecdote that I had about this poet, that he always has a kind of a little notebook. So whenever he heard or saw some a strange, bizarre, lesser used kind of words, then he will write down and take a note, and later he can use in his poetry writing. So in the way that his habit was laughed at by the other people, but in this book that I try to argue that his use of this type of difficult and lesser known vocabularies, and his extensive use of the allusions and etc. is a way to try to make the poetic language unfamiliar to his readers. So is this kind of unfamiliarity is also is in the way that to try to articulate that his kind of new feelings and new perceptions when he was facing in his world. And at the same time, he also do a lot of experimentation about the poetic the boundaries of poetic genre. For instance, in his poems that he also incorporates some kind of element from the prose writings. So it's in the way that you try to expand the boundaries of the poetic forms.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Very eloquently put. So you talked about unfamiliarity. As we move to part two of the book, we move to contexts of emergent familiarity, familiarity of these poets with one another. Part two of the book looks at the social dynamics of different affective communities, as you put it, who practiced classical style poetry. Now, there are affective communities here, and I'll ask you to talk a little bit about that in a moment, that are really, really interesting. And then the third chapter of the book, which is one of two chapters in part two, looks at poetry clubs of various sorts. The chapter begins by describing one particular gathering at the Shangsi Festival in 1913, and then uses that to move out to explore Shi and Si clubs of old-fashioned literati in Shanghai. It looks at clubs in Shanghai and Beijing in particular. It also talks about kinds of games that would be played among the poets who were members of these clubs, like the poetry bell game. And you talk about riddling and riddles as a kind of social device here, too. It's a really fascinating chapter. So as a way into this chapter, can you talk a little bit about this notion of affective community? What does this mean to you? And maybe can you give an example of an affective community from this part of the book that you feel really sums up this notion and its importance for you?
Okay. In this chapter, I try to, in this part of the book, the second part of the book, I try to use our more sociological kind of approach to the materials. So I emphasize on the poetry gatherings, clubs, and this kind of group activities. And when I try to emphasize that when we deal with this group of this type of poets and their writings, it is really important to study the communities because in many ways that it is a group activities. And as you mentioned, point out that this kind of familiarity is very important. Familiarity in the cultural terms, familiarity is also in the formal terms, in the way that they are both they are capable writing the classical style poetry, and at the same time, they also will write the poems correspondent to each other, use the same rhymes, etc. So in the way that from this kind of formal and linguistic kind of echoes, then you will exchange the feelings with your poet friends. So this is from the more kind of formal and social aspect of their gatherings. But in these chapters that I borrow this concept from the trauma studies and try to label them as kind of affective communities, because this their group activities is mainly situated after the fall of the Qing dynasties, after the 1912. So during that time, such as those loyalists, those leftovers of the Qing dynasties, there are many of them living in the place such as Shanghai and Tianjin. So they really like engage a very active kind of activities to get together to write the poems. So the poetry here serve a very important kind of functions for them to express this type of pent up emotions about the disappearing falling apart dynasties and disappearing of literary cultures. And this is very important for their kind of spiritual well-being. So in that sense, they are not just exchange the poems for the aesthetic or for the entertainment kind of purpose, but it is also in the way that to communicate and among each other in a deep spiritual and emotional level. So in this chapter, I give in the first part of this chapter, I deal with the Shangshi festivals. So this is our festival that happened in the springtime, and it has a long kind of traditions. And this Shangshi festival in the Republican era in the 1913 was actually reactivated by this an intellectual that very familiar to all the listeners, that is Liang Qichao. So you will see that the Liang Qichao also actively involved in this group of the communities. And we know that the Liang Qichao is always have the this kind of image of to be the political leader and to be a progressive in the political realm. But during this time, early Republican era, that he actually also extended involved in this group of the poets here, and also this type of poetry gatherings. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much. So in the second part of this part of the book, which we won't have time to talk about in any detail again, there's so many wonderful things we could talk about, but I'll just mention for listeners, because it's also a really interesting chapter. Chapter 4 gives us another context in which to understand poetry as a social practice by looking at a couple of case studies here. The chapter begins by looking at the literary career of Chen Yan, who's another major Tongguang style poetry critic here. He represents in this chapter the transformation of an old-fashioned literatus figure into a modern professor and scholar. And the chapter talks about some of the ways he did that, including a work called Poetry Talks, which was really, really popular. And it effectively promoted classical poetry and also promoted his own authority as an expert on the form of classical poetry in the Republican era. The last part of the chapter gives us a kind of genealogy, as you put it, of modern poets that are working in the Ci form, and it focuses on two in particular. One of them publishes a journal of Ci studies, and another founds a club, another poetry club. I love these poetry clubs. It really, really makes me want to start one. And you do end that chapter by talking about the establishment of the study of Ci as a kind of academic discipline, which is another social transformation. Now, this brings us into part three of the book. This is in many ways one of, for me, the most fascinating parts of the book. This part of the book looks very closely at traveling poets and their work, and it looks specifically at the kind of cross-fertilization, I think, as you put it, an experimentation that happens through their travel and also through the kind of translation that their travel is, and also translation activities as they're working across languages between Chinese and other languages. Okay, so chapter 5 looks at one of the figures that you mentioned very early on in our conversation. This is Lu Bicheng. Now, this chapter considers, as you put it here, the interplay of space and gendered relations by looking closely at her work. And she's a lyric poet. She's a feminist activist. She is absolutely fascinating. So can you introduce her for us? Tell us a little bit about her and what you take to be the important parts of her kind of biography that we need to understand the work that she's doing in this chapter.
Sure. I think I still vividly recall the moment that I encountered her poetry anthology. That was in 2001 when I was doing my research trip back to China, and I was staying in the Shanghai Shuchun, and because at that time was her published her poetry anthology was just published by the Shanghai Gongji. And I was literally standing there and finished reading her poetry collection, Lü Bicheng Zi Jian Zhu, and find her absolutely fascinating in all aspects. And at that time, I already know that I must write something about her. As a matter of fact, that in the past 10 years that she became so popular in mainland China, and in the way that everyone knows that she is now become kind of the best known as a female poet during the Republican era. And what is fascinating about her is that in the way that she is not only is a feminist activist, she also engages the various different aspects of the education and the newspaper publications, but also she traveled extensively to United States and to Europe, and also involve the animal rights movement in Europe during that time. And also, she also involved the translation of the Buddhist texts and devoted to the later part of her life to the Buddhism. So in many ways that her life trajectory is fascinating. But at the same time, she is also, her life story is also an enigma in many ways that is a mystery. Is many aspects of her life we still don't really know about. So in that sense, it's also very fascinating to a researcher. But I think what is most important for me is that she spent a good amount of time in traveling in Europe, and especially living in Switzerland. And she wrote a good deal about the Alps Mountains, Switzerland, wrote about the Rome, ancient Rome, etc. So in the way that those type of foreign landscape become is a new object, enter into the spatial configuration of the Ci form. As we know that the Ci, as a genre, usually expresses kind of love emotions, the spatial configuration in the Ci is usually limited to the boudoir settings, to the gardens, to the limited kind of space. But here, that she bring us to this kind of vast grandeur landscape of the foreign landscape. So in the way that this aspect is really open the horizon of the Ci poetry writing during that time. But this aspect has been well appreciated by the scholars and her contemporaries, because they try to argue that how she widened the spatial kind of presentations of the Ci poetry. In this chapter, that what I try to emphasize is that in the way that she is not only doing so to depict this kind of falling landscape in the Ci poetry, but in many ways, she also used her feminist kind of consciousness to rewrite this grandeur space in the way that turned this space of the grandeur landscape in many ways to be expressions of her feminist consciousness, and to a certain point, even this kind of female utopians to a certain extent. So in the way that she really worked on her gendered kind of identities, interweaved this gendered identities into her presentation of the falling landscape, and in a very artistic kind of way.
Thank you so much. Beautiful. And I don't have to ask you anything else about that chapter because you summarized it so gorgeously. Thank you. So not only, though, does this part of the book have that fabulous chapter, it also has another fabulous chapter. This is chapter 6, Oh, My Love is Like a Red, Red Rose, Classical Form and Translation. And the title of this chapter comes from really the set piece that opens it. And this is a piece in which you look at a translation by Su Manchu of Robert Burns's A Red, Red Rose. And you look at it, it's actually really fascinating from the perspective of translation studies and translation history to give us these poems side by side and walk us through what translation means in this context. Now, so this chapter looks at the translation and rewriting of Western poetry using classical style verse forms. Again, this, you know, classical style verse forms are really at the heart of this study. And you use Su Manchu and his poetry as a major example, as one of two major examples that we look at in this chapter. Now, I particularly love him for many reasons after reading this book. One of the reasons is that he has this sort of tragic, comical death where you say he dies at age 34. And it's not funny, you know, but listeners will understand once I say the rest of it. He dies of a digestive problem allegedly caused by eating too much candy. So, you know, just weird, right? But it kind of it immediately draws him to your attention as an interesting character. But he's particularly interesting here in this chapter because of the work that he does translating romantic poetry. So his work translating romantic poetry winds up being crucial, as you put it here, to the development of his poetic voice, and you focus on his translation of not just Burns, but also the work of romantic poets like Byron. So he self-fashions here in this part of the book as China's Byron. Can you talk a little bit about that? What makes him China's Byron, and what do we need to know about that in order to understand the larger arguments you're making in this part of the book?
Okay. I'm glad you mentioned this anecdote in the way that after the death of the Su Manchu, that there's a lot of fascinating anecdotes about him was circulating. So it's in the way that to a certain extent is why this this poet is still very fascinating to a generation of readers. So in the way that his life behavior is eccentric in certain ways, but is also during his own lifetime, he also know how to self-fashion himself to present this kind of a literary genius, but a little eccentric and go beyond the conventional Chinese kind of norm. And in many ways, this is also related to that his self-identify with this great poet, Lord Byron. So he encountered the Byron when he was studying in Japan, and he was absolutely fascinated with Byron, and he was translate the poems of the Byron and read the poems of the Byron to the courtesans, to the female friends that he was interact during that time. So in this chapter, I try to suggest that through this kind of translation work, that we know that the Baron as kind of a representative of the Western Romanticism during that time, is really have a big effect, influence on the Su Manchu himself, in the way that this type of concept about about the modern love as an ideal, as an individual behavior, was translated and influenced that his own writings and his daily behavior. So, for instance, I point out that in his poetry, that he really used the first person pronoun a lot to articulate love emotions or his like turmoil, the conflict between the love and his religious commitment, very well in his poems and this kind of struggles. And why it is so unique? Because in the past, in the China's traditional past, when you express the love, usually the first person male voice is always repressed. We had a lot of female love voice express the love, but not so much about from the male literatis, and also not so much about expression of the love at the present sense. But he did a lot in his own poetry writings, and I tried to establish this linkage because he was translate a lot Robert Burns and the Lord Byrons. So in many ways, that this concept of the modern love also through his translation that affect that his own individual poetic work.
Great. Thank you so much. Now, there's also an example of another poet in this chapter, and it's actually a poet named Wu Mi, and it's a poet who gives this part of the book its title in a way. Part 3, Lighting the Modern Torch with Ancient Fire, is titled after, as you tell us here, a favorite poem of Wu Mi. Right? And you say that this poem really represents his lifelong dream and his work, and you talk in this section of the book about his translations of Christina Rossetti and Matthew Arnold in particular. And it's, again, a really beautiful way into not just his poetry, but also the translation of poetry as a craft. And that the reason why I'm not asking you to talk specifically about his process is that I'd like to ask you to talk a little bit about your process before we come to the end. And I ask that because one of the really amazing things about this book, and I'm not being hyperbolic here, I really mean that, it's a really gorgeously written book, is that your own craft as a translator of poetry. And by translator, I don't just mean, although I also mean rendering Chinese prose into English prose, but I also mean opening, using your translation to open up the prose for us and take us inside and give us a window into a really, a much more beautiful world than we would have a window into otherwise through your work. This is a really striking part of the book, and it's clearly, at least it seems to me as a reader, and we haven't talked about this before, but it seems to me as a reader that translation of poetry seems like a crucial part of your own work. So I wonder if you would just speak to us a little bit about that, your work as a translator, as it informed the poetry translations you did that were published in this book. And are there any elements of your craft that are particularly important? Were there any poems in the book that you felt particularly strongly about as a translator? And can you bring us into your world as a translator of poetry just a little bit?
Okay, sure. I think you brought up a very important issue here is as a scholar, as a translator, as a scholar like Wu Mi, and as our translator was trying to bring those verse and into English language, that in the way that we constantly struggle with this kind of negotiation between the content and the form. So this is what Wu Mi did, that in his writing is that he really tried to turn these classical forms be able to accommodate the modern content. And so this is what he meant to that 旧古人之诗火 旧古人之诗火兮，五禅之列句可以引燃. So in the way that the tradition could be invigorated by the means of the inspiration of the foreign cultures and accommodating the modern thoughts in this type of classical forms. So in the way that he tried to negotiate between this content and the form. And as a translator, I myself as a translator here, I must confess that I had a very hard time to bring their beautiful, absolutely beautiful written verse into English. And I myself was struggled a lot. And I don't entirely satisfied with the result. I think they're readable in some sense. I think because when I am facing this kind of the translation, and especially when we come to the poetic forms in the translation, many aspects, especially the formal aspect, was almost completely lost through the translation. So in many ways, I try to bring the content into the and translation, but their craftsmanship and their meticulous attention to the form, to the rhymes, and to this kind of patterns that's sort of lost during the translation. But I think in the way that this is also universally encountered issues when we come to the verse translation, as Ezra Pound suggests before, that if you can, you know, get the 90% content through, then it's already a divine accident. So in the way that I hope I, you know, accomplish in the way that somehow to a certain extent that rendered their meanings through the translation.
It's really wonderful. And this is also a great chance for me to mention for listeners that Chapter 6 not only gives us the story of these translators and beautiful translations of your own. I think they're beautiful. You may not have been satisfied, but I think they're gorgeous. But it's also, it offers a really wonderful entree into some of the most important, or some important moments in translation theory. So readers interested in translation studies in particular will find a lot to work with in Chapter 6. Now, the epilogue, I won't ask you to talk too much about it because, again, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I will mention for listeners that the epilogue does a really beautiful job leading us from the context of the book in this Qing and Republican context outward into the more immediate past and the future by, in part, relating your experience of going to an exhibition of contemporary Chinese ink painting at the MFA in Boston while finishing the book, and you sort of lead us into these spaces of sort of reimagining classical forms as a way of creating a different kind of space and as a way of changing the present in a way that I think is really a wonderful end point on the study. So thank you for that, and I want to just mention that. Thanks. For our listeners. So, Shangqing, there's a ton of material that we didn't have a chance to talk about. It's an extraordinarily rich book, as I'm sure is obvious to listeners just from the past hour. Is there anything in particular about this book that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Kara, I think you have already done a wonderful job to summarize the major points that I made in this book. If there's something I must add, I will simply say that, as I mentioned earlier, that Lei Qing poetry study is, relatively speaking, is an uncharted territory. So working through those materials is a very challenging experience for me, but I must add that is also a very rewarding intellectually kind of an experience for me. So I really encourage our young scholars, when choose the dissertation topic or research topic, you should go through, you should avoid the crowd and go into those areas that which still remain uncharted. Thanks.
Good advice. Very good. So Sengqing, I know that you are already working on another project that you are excited about. So would you like to tell us a little bit about what you're up to now?
Sure. Yeah, I'm very excited about this a new project that I was working on. That deal with the relationship between image and text. It's actually part of the project related to this classical poetry writing. Is that when I go through those poets' anthology and collections, I find that they wrote a good number of the poems about the photos and or inscribed onto the photos. So this phenomenon sort of fascinated me. So in the way that I'm doing research now, so I try to examine this kind of relationship between the photography and the text and the poetry in particular. So I give you a few examples. For instance, there is it's actually related to the Schumann, so I mentioned it. Yeah.
The zither player, right? The zither player he was really into. Yeah, sorry, go on.
Right. Yeah, so he has this the photos of the courtesans, of the Japanese courtesans. So he will inscribe the poems onto that photos, and that photos will be circulated among his male friend. So it's a fascinating kind of case to examine how the expression of the heterosexual desire as a way to consolidate the male friendship. But at the same time, you also see that this object, the photo accompanied with the poems, was also circulated among the communities as a way to exchange the feelings. So this is one example. Another example, for instance, that there's a good number of the poets write the poems about the self, the image of the self. So it's in the way that I try to examine that how this photography, different from the paintings, this kind of different visual medias, whether they have the different effect onto the perception about the self, and also about the different effect on the writing about the self. And also in the way that, because we know that the photography, when photography was introduced into China in the mid-19th century, so the Chinese literati really turned it into a plaything of their own, add a lot of theatrical kind of elements into their photo shooting experience. For instance, they like to shoot the double portrait self, or they like to juxtapose the multiple self into one image, or they shoot the cross-dressed self, etc. So this has become part of a fascinating kind of phenomena related to the literati practice and use of this new visual media. So I'm very excited about this project and want to deal with this issue, this kind of interaction between the image and the text, and also deal with thematically that how the emotion is evoked and traveled among the communities. Thanks.
I love it. Okay, so go write that book, and then I get to read that book, and then we'll talk about that book. So, another fantastic project. Sengqing, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure both to read the book and also to talk with you about it, and I really appreciate your time. So congratulations, and thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Kara, for this wonderful opportunity.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.